Good afternoon and welcome to Talk of the Towns. We try to go beyond the headlines to make sense of the issues facing Maine communities, to share what works and to seek alternative solutions. Talk of the Towns is aired on WERU Community Radio since 1993, dedicated to the proposition that everyone benefits when we share our knowledge, our experience, our concerns, and our perspectives. We're about to practice the magic of community radio, in which those of us in our virtual studio and you who are listening create a dialogue we hope will be of benefit to our friends, our neighbors, and colleagues. I'm your co-host, Ron Beard. Liz Graves is off this week. Hoping you'll stay with us for the next hour and Talk of the Towns. And just a reminder, recording this show in advance and won't be taking any calls today. Well, if you're lucky, like me, we get to walk in the woods. We notice the earthy scent of leaf litter or blossoms in season. We might hear a bird call, a murmur of a brook, or a sigh of wind through the tree branches. We might feel warmth in patches of sun, cool in the shade, and with all of our senses, we could imagine ourselves as trees. And in her new book, The Trees of Acadia, science writer Catherine Schmidt draws intimate portraits of 15 species of trees which make up the forest of our easternmost national park. She weaves indigenous connections, historical records, and current research into a story that enlivens every walk in the woods. And so I'm really happy to have my colleague and friend Catherine Schmidt with us. She is a science writer at Scooting Institute, and previous books include A Coastal Companion and The President's Salmon. Welcome to Talk of the Towns, Catherine.
Hi, Ron. Thanks so much for having me. It's always great to be here on WERU.
Sure. And you've brought some colleagues of yours along. Nick Fisichelli is the Scooting Institute President. Welcome to you, Nick. We'll learn more about your work in just a moment.
Hi, Ron. Thanks so much for having me.
And also joining us is Caroline Kaneski. Did I pronounce that right, Caroline?
Yep.
Great. She's a forest ecologist and now assistant professor of forestry at the University of Maine, Fort Kent, and some of her research added to the story that we're going to talk about today, The Trees of Acadia. So perhaps each of you could give us a little background on yourselves that helps our listeners understand who's in our virtual studio. Catherine, we'll start with you. Just a little bit of background on yourself.
Sure. I'm a writer, a science writer focusing mostly on nonfiction about science, the environment, nature, and the history of all those things and human relations with all of those things. I've been a science communication specialist at Scutic Institute since 2018. And before that, I worked at the Maine Sea Grant College Program at the University of Maine directing communications. And I also am a freelance journalist and write about mostly the Northeastern environment.
Great.
I live in Bangor and I've been in Maine for about 25 years.
Great. And you and I were colleagues at the University of Maine Sea Grant, and that's where I had the pleasure of meeting you and working with you. Nick, tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to Scutic Institute.
Yeah, I like, Ron, how you started the show here. If we're lucky, we get to walk often in the woods. And I think that was my sort of beginnings growing up here in the Northeast, where there's abundant woods. And you know, my backyard was a white pine forest. And as a young kid, it felt like a sort of a forest primeval, if you will, and that it had always been that way. And of course, that's absolutely false, that forests are super dynamic. They're always changing. And I think as I came to realize that, it really got me hooked on trees and forests. And I think that led to my career. There's been this common thread of studying forests. And, you know, trees operate on a different time scale from people, and it's not always easy to see. And so that was really exciting for me. And then lastly, also in college, I took a tree identification class. And so the woods that I often walked through suddenly, you know, they came more alive. I think I knew the names of the trees as I walked through the forest. I knew the names of my friends. And so now at Scutic Institute, you know, my role is really to support the science and education and science communication. And so really work that Catherine leads and then also work with partners and through postdoctoral fellowships, for example, that Caroline's done some amazing research that she maybe talk a little bit about as well. So my role is really to support the science and education related to forests and beyond.
Right. And you're based at the Skudik Institute, which is Winter Harbor. Is that how we say it?
Yes. So Skudik Institute, right. We are a conservation science and education nonprofit organization. So together with our National Park Service colleagues, we co-lead Acadia's Research Learning Center. And so as a partner organization, our role is to really bring the science expertise to help managers steward Acadia amidst rapid change. So this includes, you know, restoring habitats like summits and wetlands, and salt marshes, of course, forests as well. It includes working with harvesters in the intertidal to steward a healthy intertidal ecosystem. It's also engaging the next generation in the science and stewardship. So that's from postdoctoral research fellowships, like what Caroline had, to post-college fellowships, to all the way down to middle school students, getting them into Acadia for multi-day overnight education experiences, these sort of hands-on, feet-in experiences. And all the work that we do is through partnerships. So certainly with National Park Service, with Friends of Acadia, and with lots of other partners. And then lastly, our campus, which is a former Navy base, it's also a meeting and conference facility. So at the tip of the Skudik Peninsula. And it's for groups of all kinds to come and have experiences in Acadia.
Great. Thanks so much. Caroline, tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got interested in trees and science, and what led you to your current position.
Yeah, thanks, Ron. I think, you know, just like Nick said, being outside and really learning about the trees around me was really meaningful to me as a kid. I remember in high school biology class, one of our things we had to do was collect leaves and press them and try to identify all of them. And that was really, you know, giving names to things that I had been surrounding myself with and walking amongst my whole life pretty much. So I got pulled into entomology via trees because lots of insects feed on trees. And it's part of this really amazing evolution and diversity of trees around us, especially in the northeastern U.S. and Canada. And so over the past like 10 years or so, I've really embraced forest entomology as kind of my career focus. And I spent a good chunk of that time as a PhD student at the University of New Hampshire studying with Jeff Garnes in his forest health lab. And I particularly focused on southern pine beetles, which they can kill pine trees. And so that's kind of how I got roped into or like pulled into the Acadian ecosystem. I'm not from New England, but I really love it up here. And so after I graduated last May with my PhD, I started this past fall at University of Maine, Fort Kent, and I get to teach things like dendrology, tree identification, forest health, entomology. And so it's been a really awesome experience so far to be up here, kind of in a different forest type. We're very spruce fir up here, but it's very beautiful all the same. And the other thing, the other piece of kind of my research focus is community ecology. So understanding how, you know, animals and plants interact with each other. And that includes us too. I also love diving into like the history of science, how we do science, who's come before me, so I can really understand the context of my work and what I'm building upon.
Great, great. Well, Catherine, what I'd like you to do is give us an introduction by reading a piece from this wonderful book, The Trees of Acadia. So go ahead.
This is the very beginning of the book. It begins on Cadillac Mountain summit. It's 4 o'clock in the morning, cloudy, foggy. The robins have started singing, followed by white-throated sparrows. The slamming of car doors mixes with the clacking of hiking poles and footsteps on gravel. A baby cries, a dog barks. Other birds join the chorus, song sparrows and chipping sparrows, common yellowthroats, tuis and juncos, and a black and white warbler, sweet, sweet, sweet. The air grows quiet. A haze of pale pink seeps through the gray, brightening the upper branches of balsam fir trees clustered on the summit of what to the Wabanaki is White Mountain of the First Light, 1,527 feet above the sea. Looking down, trees spread in all directions. To the east is another mountain, a wall of yellow-green pitch pine, which flourished after a great fire in 1947. That same fire burned thousands of acres, marked by streaks of birch, aspen, and maple on northern slopes. To the west, more hills, where spruce, fir, and hemlock have filled in scars of older fires and clear cuts. In between, the lowlands are interrupted by cedar swamps, black spruce bogs, beaver meadows, and pine-edged lakes. To the south, pitch pines mingle with jack pines, trees that have found refuge on the cool, wind-swept ridge of this highest mountain along the east coast. Red spruce, the most common species of tree in Acadia, grows all the way down to the sea. White spruce lines the edges of the islands and peninsulas from Eilaho to Skudik Point. Across these lands, now known as Acadia National Park, trees are the most common scenery, forests the most common ecosystem. Trees support a diversity of wildlife, protect lakes and streams, clean the air, and pull more carbon dioxide from the atmosphere than they put back. All forests, of course, have these functions. But Acadia's forests are special for many reasons. Acadia lies within a transition zone between a temperate south and a boreal north. Warm climate species overlap with cold adapted trees. The range and elevations and proximity to the ocean create even more habitat. Protected for more than a century, the trees have aged in place with a diversity of plants and animals that only live in older forests. Nowhere else on Earth has Acadia's mix of forest types in such a small area. Visitors sense this. Even as they face the dawn, the edges of their views are softened by a multitude of textures. They hear layers of song from birds that nest in birch branches and spruce shadows, feel the wind blowing through pines, taste salt in the air, and breathe the healing fragrance of balsam fir.
Wonderful. That was Catherine Schmidt reading from her new book called The Trees of Acadia. We're joined as well by Nick Fisichelli, who is the president of the Skudik Institute, and Carol Kaneski, who is a forest ecologist, assistant professor at the University of Maine at Fort Kent. Catherine, Trees of Acadia covers 15 species of trees and their related connections, like balsam fir, which begins the book, and their ecological neighbors and how humans, including the Wabanaki people, encountered them. Tell us a little bit how the overstory of the book, an analogy, I suppose, to an overstory of a forest. How did the book originate and what motivated you to write it?
Started working at Skudik Institute, I came, as we've shared already, from the Sea Grant program at UMaine. So I had been writing about the coast and oceans and kind of immersed in fisheries, mostly some water quality estuaries. And I had been doing that for what felt like a long time. So when I came to Skudik, I was really excited to write about trees and to write about birds, which were have been a focus of researchers at Skudik Institute. And Nick was someone who I was working closely with, initially kind of working on some historical ecology. So researching previous forest research in the park is what I sort of dove into immediately upon beginning that work. And at the time, Nick was conducting experiments, which I think we'll hear about, and I'll let him talk about those. But Nick was conducting a lot of forest and tree growth experiments. I actually got to plant trees during my first year at Skudik. And so I was just learning about forests and catching up. I did not take forest ecology in any of my environmental science training. I was more of a sort of water hydrology person, wetlands person, and so I had never taken forest ecology, never took dendrology, although I also grew up with woods in my backyard. So I knew trees in a different way. So I just immersed myself in it and quickly realized how special Acadia's forests were And also quickly realized, mostly from Nick, how much in the background the trees are. And this book was really trying to bring that knowledge into the foreground and hope that people look at the trees, not as scenery, but really come to appreciate the trees. I also knew from some of my previous writing and research that the forests and sort of concern for what was happening to the forests in what is now Acadia were the inspiration for the people who called for its protection. So trees were actually the original inspiration for the creation of what became Acadia. And that story, while it's not really a secret, there are published statements about that, but that history just got buried. It got overshadowed by a lot of the other stories of Acadia's founding. And so I really wanted to bring that to the forefront as well.
So that just to highlight mm-hmm. that threat was that forests in Acadia were being cut over very rapidly. And people said, is that really what we want for the future? And Acadia or its predecessor was in reaction to the fact that their forest was disappearing. The traditional forest that they knew had been disappearing.
Yes.
So this is not a Roger Torrey Peterson field guide to trees. This is a much more intimate story. And you take us on some wonderful walks, familiar to me because I live on the border of Acadia. And I went to visit one of your hemlock trees just the other day. So tell us a little bit more about the kind of connection to our senses. You write about, you make us feel present in the forest. So tell us a little bit about that and some of the additional parts of researching this book. You take us to those places.
I do. So the descriptions of the different trees, right? So every chapter is based around a certain species of tree. Of course, I couldn't cover them all, so I sort of selected the most common trees in Acadia and structured the book that way. And I used it, I wanted to highlight particular places where the trees grew. So it is a field guide in the sense of, if you want to see these trees and get to know them, these are the places that you can go. And I walked those trails and tried to be that guide and bring people along trails. And one thing that was really important to me was making sure that all of the trees I wrote about were accessible. I didn't want to write about places that were off trail or places that were hard to get to. I wanted it to be places that other people could experience. And so I tried to, stay on trails and stay in particular locations to make the trees accessible. And then it's also a place, like there's so many different places, locations in Acadia. This is definitely a book I was thinking of people who knew Acadia and were familiar with it really as my audience, but also did try to not move around too much. So not bounce all over the park, but try to flow. If you started at the page one, could you walk all the way to page 200 or whatever. So that was sort of making sure that the flow of how we moved around made sense. And then each particular location, there's also a chronological structure of past to future. And so the first chapters are about how the forest came to be, post-glacial forest development, what we know about forest history and the history of earliest human relations with our forests. And then kind of move into more intensive human relations with the forest and sort of different ways in the history of logging and the history of clear cutting and the history of fire in Acadia, and sort of move through and which of those stories made sense for which species.
Mm. Talk about
Did
some
I miss
of the
anything?
Source.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's that.
Yeah.
Talk about some of the sources that you connected with. We're going to talk a little bit more about the science in a few minutes, but some of the other sources, the historical sources that you connected with.
Early, quote, explorer, unquote, accounts. So we have written records begin with European exploration and settlement. we have oral histories from Wabanaki people and stories that have been passed down that contain knowledge of the forests within them. We have early maps. So sort of combining individual personal witness accounts with maps of what was there. So what, right, like what trees were here were some of my sources. Newspaper records, so looking up specific locations and specific, one of the things, and I tried to be transparent in the book and say where my accounts came from. So letters, right? There's letters of Abraham Soames is writing to his lawyer about how he came to be in the town that came to be named after him. So letters, journals, field books. I went to the Massachusetts Historical Society and looked at the field notebooks of some of the surveyors who were out surveying for early property owners. Handwritten, hand-drawn maps, looking for mentions of oak trees, or were there pine trees there? What kind of pines? We don't know. They just said pines. It looked at the French translation of Champlain because the pines, firs, and birches, I wanted to actually look at the French and see and look at what, you know, what trees was he describing? So that kind of in-depth research. Yeah.
Great. I'm fascinated too with some of the property transitions that you saw as uses of the forest changed, the property changed hands. And that's a fascinating story. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's deeds, right? So that's land transaction and property deeds. So Hancock Registry of Deeds, and it works by names. And I actually learned how to do title research as when I was an environmental consultant, and to understand if a property was polluted and the uses of property over time, I was taught how to do deed research, and they link to each other. So you can work backwards in time, because within those deeds, when property is transferred between property owners, the property is described in the deed. And so you might see, so I was looking for mentions of a mill building. Is what's being transferred, does that include a mill? A lot of the deeds will say something like, and all of the lumber as far as it grows. People were splitting up the rights to the lumber. So there might have been six different men who had title to the lumber on a property, and then they split off because they're not making enough money. They split off a share. So just trying to, by going through the people, you learn about the land and the history of the land. And so I was looking for who was logging it. And then I wanted to know, what were they logging it for? So who did they own a sawmill? Were they selling it for fire, you know, to the lime industry in Rockland for firewood? But then by understanding who owned the property, then you research that individual and their history to find out what they did for a living and maybe what the trees were being used for.
Great. Well, you've woven together so many stories, and part of them are the contemporary researchers, folks like Nick. Nick, tell us a little bit more about the particular research that you helped conduct. We'll talk a little bit about the future forest and some of the climate change in a minute, but just give us a general sense of the forest research that you helped with.
Yeah, this research was really, you know, about understanding the dynamism of forests and how they're changing, and how factors like a warming climate and invasive species or insects, which Caroline will talk about, you know, how all of these things interact, and really understanding which species are going to do well and which are going to struggle. And since trees operate on these long time scales, it's sometimes hard to understand those responses. And so using, you know, through our sort of science lens, you know, we do observational studies out in the field just of what's happening here. We do sort of controlled experiments, say in common gardens, and where we may plant all the same tree species together at different locations, or we may even do growth chamber experiments where you're even controlling conditions even more. And so using just a lot of different methods to try to understand how trees are responding. And surprisingly, I guess trees are complicated, which makes them fascinating to study. And then the way that they're interacting with, certainly with one another, with their physical environment, the climate, and then with other species that they're sharing the forest with, such as insects, all sort of interact and determine which species are going to thrive and which are going to struggle.
Great. Catherine, back to you. You cover some really wonderful researchers going back in the past. Maybe you just highlight some of the people that you talked with about their research, other than Nick and Caroline, who we'll talk with more in just a moment. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a pretty big list of scientists. Contemporary scientists whom I was able to talk with include people like Molly Schoeffler, who conducted her PhD research in Acadia looking at the history of forests. So taking cores of wetland sediment where pollen gets deposited in layers over time, and from analyzing those layers, you can understand what trees were growing in the environment. And that research really showed how spruce and fir have been growing on the coasts continuously for thousands of years, which is very different from interior areas of the region, which got too warm and dry for spruce and fir. And her research really helped to document that. So we know that there's been a spruce fir forest at Skudik for 5,000-6,000 years, for example, and some other really special places along the coast of Maine. And maybe that means that the coast might provide a similar refuge in the future. And so I, had email exchanges with Molly and had known her from my time at the University of Maine. And people always, they enjoy reminiscing and going back to their graduate school research. And then the Park Service scientists. Another objective of writing this book was to convey how cared for these forests are and how National Park Service scientists work so hard and care so much about the trees. And I wanted to just give a little bit of insight. And they really know the trees well, including individual trees. So Kate Miller, who's a quantitative ecologist with the National Park Service, who managed crews of forest technicians who monitor forest health in national parks from Maine to Virginia. And those crews go out every summer, and there's permanent monitoring sites that are set up, and they go and they measure tree health and tree growth and look at the understory and see what's on the ground and what's coming up to be the future forest. And Kate conducted her PhD research on forests in Acadia and park forests in general. And it's her research that shows a lot of why Acadia's forests are special now. So it's great. It's always great to go out in the woods with Kate. Jesse Wheeler is also a vegetation program manager at Acadia National Park, and he manages teams of people who help to keep invasive shrubs and vines from growing in the forest and preventing the growth of trees. And so in a lot of parks to our south, they don't have an understory of trees. They have an understory of shrubs because of these plants that didn't evolve here. And so Jesse's team, through their kind of vigilance and really close attention, has helped to keep Acadia's forests as forests and keep them healthy. And so Jesse and Emma Lanning, who works with Jesse, they always, let me tag along in the field as they're girdling ash trees or putting out insect traps or checking for southern pine beetles. So those are just a few of the probably dozens of scientists featured in the park.
And one of those is Caroline. Would you like to introduce her a little bit? Tell her how you kind of connected with Caroline and her work, and then we'll let her talk a little bit more about her work. Yeah.
I actually wrote a news story for the magazine Northern Woodlands about Caroline's research of detecting the presence of southern pine beetle in me. And this was the first detection. And that was big news for the region, and wrote a short news piece about that for Northern Woodlands Magazine. And in talking with Caroline, I realized that, you know, I talked to her about the pitch pine in Acadia and mentioned of the Second Century Stewardship Fellowship, which is now the Acadia Science Fellowship. But I mentioned the opportunity to Caroline, and, you know, she ended up applying and being awarded that fellowship.
Great. And I'll just remind listeners, they're tuned to Talk of the Towns. We're talking with Catherine Schmidt about her new book called The Trees of Acadia. Contributors to that include Nick Visicelli, who is the president of the Skudik Institute, a researcher there as well, and Caroline Konaski, who is a forest ecologist. So glad to have all of them with us to talk about the trees of Acadia. Caroline, we meet you in the chapter on pitch pine, and you were a doctoral student at the University of New Hampshire, and you, Catherine just noted, you documented the presence of the southern pine beetle, an insect that elsewhere has decimated pitch pine woodlands. Tell us a little bit about pitch pines and how you came to do that work and some of the trends that you saw.
Yeah, wow. Well, I love pitch pine as a tree species. It's a very common tree. I think Catherine already mentioned, like, on the rocky slopes and summits of Cadillac and Door and Champlain, that kind of eastern mountain desert island area. And this is a pine that you might describe as like kind of gnarly, like twisted. It's not tall and majestic like our state tree in Maine, the eastern white pine. And to kind of contrast as well, so white pine has 5 needles per bundle, or fascicle, as we might say in dendrology. And pitch pine has 3 needles, and they're quite rigid, which is kind of how pitch pine gets its Latin name, Pinus rigida. So rigid needles, also has rigid cones. I really admire the pitch pine for its ability to grow in places that seem really inhospitable, like straight up sand, you know, especially in southern Maine, like in York County, we have like the pitch pine sand plains near Kennebunk, Waterboro. And then it also grows like straight out of the granite on Mount Desert Island. So places where you might not think that a tree can thrive. And because of these like harsh environments, the trees can be quite slow to grow. So you can find a tree that's pretty small, but is actually quite old. And so it's really interesting to see how these trees have kind of lasted through a lot of environmental change and probably will continue. This is a tree species that responds really well to fire, as Catherine also mentioned. So like the fires of 1947 that burned on Mount Desert Island, a lot of pitch pines grew up in the boundary of that fire. That's also true for fires in southern Maine in the same year. Pitch pine kind of has a lot of adaptations that make it really adapted for fire, or it likes fire. It has really thick, kind of chunky, blocky bark that protects the tree from fire, protects the tree from dying. Its cones are super sturdy and they open when it gets really hot, and the seeds germinate better when there's fire around, or when the ground has been burned. And something else that folks should know about this tree is that especially in Acadia, we kind of find pitch pine with a scrub oak or bare oak understory. So kind of naturally, it has a more shrubby understory. And there's also lots of blueberries and huckleberries. And so even though this forest type can be very hot, it's not super shady all the time. There's a lot of rewarding snacks in the pitch pine woodlands, which is very nice. But so as Catherine said, like, I've been studying southern pine beetle since about 2017. And it's been making this northward range expansion, kind of moving up from the southern U.S. Over the past several decades. And so my PhD work included researching the natural enemies of southern pine beetle, so things that eat it. And I also studied how we can use drones to detect southern pine beetle damage, try to save some of these forests or take some action if we can figure out where the beetles are, which for a tiny beetle, they're kind of like a needle in the haystack sometimes. These beetles are the size of a half grain of rice, very tiny. But so the damage they're able to do is actually pretty extraordinary, given how small they are. And then my work in Acadia, I'll get to that in a moment, but we kind of need to understand like what Southern pine beetle really wants as a resource, I suppose. Historically, the cold winters have prevented southern pine beetle from living in the northeastern U.S., surviving that winter. For most insects, they really, the thing that limits them from living further north is the coldest night of the year. And so since it hasn't been getting super cold, the beetles can survive further north. And that's probably why I found a few beetles in York County in Maine in the Waterboro Barrens in 2021. Besides the cold winter or the not cold winter, the other thing that allows the beetles to survive and really thrive in their environment is their food source. So any place that has the hard pines, including pitch pine, is a place where southern pine beetles might want to be and might thrive. And it's not just the presence of the food source, but it's really kind of the abundance and the arrangement of the food source. That was the main focus of my research in Acadia National Park. When the pines are really densely packed in the forest, the beetles have a much easier time finding their food. Just the odds that they fly into a tree that is a good food source is higher. But the dense forest also allows the beetles to communicate more easily with each other, leading to more damage. And the beetles are really interesting in that they use chemical communication. So they communicate via pheromones to signal to each other where they are and that, oh, hey, I found a good tree to lay eggs in. And when the trees are close together, the chemicals remain in the forest, in the canopy. But when the trees are more spaced out, almost how you might imagine trees in a savanna environment, the chemicals dissipate out into the environment much more easily, and the beetles' communication is weaker. And so I visited almost every pitch pine stand in the park, which was a real special experience. And I measured how big the pitch pines were, how many there were in a given area, and how open the canopy was to get a sense of the resources that southern pine beetle might encounter. If it was in Acadia, no one has detected southern pine beetle in the park yet. But given the warming winters, it's probably only a matter of time. And I really got some interesting results from my forest study. The pitch pine forests in Acadia were pretty dense. The trees are pretty close together, which is quite typical of unmanaged pitch pine woodlands. But I also found that the canopy was pretty open, suggesting that the chemical communication would be quite weak between the beetles. And this open canopy is probably a result of kind of the shorter, twisted nature of the park's pitch pines, which we sometimes call dwarf form. So it's a pretty special type of tree or growth adaptation of our trees in Acadia.
Mm, wonderful. Thanks for that story. The fact that it's not here, but it's likely to be here. It's moving. Nick, this takes us to you and your research a little bit. But one of the things I'm observing is that Acadia is a managed place. It's not a place that has been set aside to let nature take its course. The park is attempting to manage in some way what's happening to it. Talk a little bit about that difference in philosophy between a preservation place that we might set aside and not see any management, and a park that is semi-managed. Tell us a little bit about that before we talk about some of your work.
I think overall the forests, are lightly managed. Perhaps I would say in a place like Acadia, dealing with some of the stressors, such as a invasive species. Certainly fire is managed in Acadia as well. There's obviously a spectrum of management intensity. And some places, lumber is extracted from forests. Of course, that doesn't happen in Acadia. So on that spectrum, there's much less active and intensive management happening. Although it's a big question for conservation today, with just the pace of change that's happening, what is appropriate for management interventions given the pace of change? Mm. And I've learned a lot from Catherine about the importance of language and how it really, really drives our thinking. And conservation is sort of a practice. The language of conservation is all about looking at the past. The words like conservation or preservation It's really about keeping things as they were. Even the practice of restoration is restoring really what may have been there in the past. And so just the language of conservation is always pushing us to look back, to use the past as that blueprint or yardstick for current management. Mm. And it's a super handy yardstick. If the forest today looks like what was there in the past, you know, at some frankly arbitrary point in the past, then, you know, then management is successful. Right. And, you know, of course, this was always somewhat problematic because forests are dynamic, but just the rate of today's rapid changes make it even more of a challenge. Right. And so it's something that really managers are grappling with today. And you know, the work of Caroline and other researchers are really helping to inform managers about how fast changes may be coming and then to think through what the management options are. And especially in a place like Acadia that may typically have a toolbox of management options different than, say, a managed forest where there may be more lumber extraction.
Great. Well, we meet you in the chapter on red maple, and we could probably devote a whole program, and maybe we will at some point, on the topic of how trees and other vegetation migrate in response to climate change. And again, we're talking about historical records, and your focus has been also on the future forest, the fact that this is not going to be the forest that we see 150, 200, 300 years from now. Talk a little bit about your interest in the red maple particular, but the future forest.
Yeah, yes. Thanks, Ron. The future forest. I find that such an interesting topic.
Yeah.
And just, you know, the future isn't written yet. And so what can we know or try to understand about the future? Can we apply a science lens? You know, I'm a scientist. Can we apply a science lens to get some little sneak peek of what the future may look like? You know, and again, which species will thrive and which will struggle under emerging conditions? And we really surprisingly know very little on this topic. As I said before, trees are complicated, which makes them really fascinating to study. And so for listeners out there, if you're not driving right now, pull out your phone, pull up your photo album and find the first photo you can from your most recent trip to Acadia. And in that photo, in the background, there's going to be a tree, maybe even a forest in the background. I would wager that your first photo you find, there's going to be trees in it. I mean, that is Acadia. It's a forested landscape, and it's probably a spruce tree. That's in your background, in your photo. It's the most common tree in Acadia. It's the most common tree in the state of Maine. And yet it's projected to struggle under emerging conditions here in the state. And as Catherine shared, you know, some of Acadia did operate as a refugium during the mid-Holocene warm period a few thousand years ago. So spruce persisted here at the tip of the Scutic Peninsula during that warm period, whereas interior Maine, it really shifted up into Canada. And then over the subsequent couple thousand years, it's come back into Maine and is now the most common tree. So, and some of that was that work of Molly Schaffler that Catherine mentioned. And just looking at those timescales, you can see how dynamic the Maine's forests have been. And we know we're getting warmer. I mean, just the fact that Caroline discovered southern pine beetle in Maine, you know, that just, it sort of boggles my mind that, you know, this is this species of insect from the southern U.S. Maybe, you know, the pine barrens of New Jersey were considered sort of northern population for the species. And already with the warming of the last few decades, it's moved quickly and it's already been found here in the state of Maine. And then again, just underscores the pace of change today. And so where is spruce going to persist in the future? Will Acadia continue to be a place that it grows, or will other species come in? And then as I mentioned before, about, you know, using the past as a blueprint for management. You know, if spruce isn't the tree in the background of your photo that, say, your great grandkids take when they're in Acadia, what tree is it going to be? What is successful conservation of this cherished place, right? This is our natural heritage that's protected in this place. And so what's it going to look like in the future, and what do managers aim for? And so that's been sort of some of our research on the future forest, just to help understand ongoing and future changes and which species are going to thrive.
Mm. And red maples, talk a little bit about red maples.
Yeah, red maple. Yes, red maple is this amazing tree that we're close to its northern limit here in Maine. It's a tree that has a huge range, though. It's found from Maine all the way down to Florida, and we find it growing there. Maybe next to that spruce tree in your photo, there may be a red maple next to that tree. And spruces, certainly red spruce is the most abundant of the spruces here, but we also have white spruce and black spruce in Acadia, which are these true boreal species, these cold adapted species. They grow from here through boreal Canada all the way up to Alaska. So if you visited Denali and taken some photos there, there's probably a white spruce or a black spruce in your photo, which is the same spruce as here. And so these are tree species that have these huge ranges, you know, across the continent, but they're only found growing together across a really narrow sort of latitudinal band, which corresponds to just a couple degrees of temperature that they're found growing together. And so this is why a place like Acadia, that is in this transition zone, as Catherine said, between these warm temperate forests to the south and the more cold adapted boreal forest to the north. And so a species like red maple is projected to do well under emerging conditions. And so part of our research is to understand that species and is that the case for it? Or are there maybe other stressors outside of a warming climate that may cause it to struggle? And we're seeing that with other species today. Unfortunately, beech trees have a long history of struggle now due to, first it was beech bark disease, and then just within the last few years now in Acadia, beech leaf disease is basically, you know, everywhere. And that's true here, you know, in Maine, it's spread very quickly. And so we're seeing, you know, some changes happen slowly over thousands of years, and other things are happening very quickly. And so part of our research is to understand how do those things interact to influence the future forest.
Mm. I'll come back in just a minute after I remind listeners about who we're listening to, and ask you about some of the limited management things that Acadia can do to look at some of these challenges in a dynamic forest. I'll come back in just a minute and ask all of you for that kind of information. But just to remind listeners, we're your turn to Talk of the Towns. We're talking about The Trees of Acadia, soon to be published by Down East Books, written by Catherine Schmidt, who is our guest today. She's a science writer, communication specialist at Skudik Institute. Nick Fisichelli, as you just heard from him, he's the president at Skudik Institute and a researcher there. And Caroline Kanaski, who is a forest ecologist now at the University of Maine at Fort Kent. So what, given all this information, this science, what does Acadia do with this information? How do they use it to, as Nick said, lightly manage, and in reaction to some of these changes? Start with Nick, and we'll see if the other guests have comments as well.
Yeah, I guess first on that, I will say we are not managers.
Right. You're providing science to those who have a responsibility for managing.
Right.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. And I don't speak for National Park Service in any of this. But I will say it's you know, part of that paradigm shift of conservation from sort of protecting the past to fostering the future. And so this is what managers are grappling with today, and what are the appropriate management interventions? And so some that have been ongoing, you know, controlling invasive species is something that has been done, continues to be done. Management with fire, whether it's suppression or prescribed burns, is something that, you know, more broadly across forests, you know, is an option. There's questions if, say, there is a big disturbance such as southern pine beetle coming in. Is it appropriate to say do some replanting after a big disturbance like that? And there's a lot of questions to that. And is that appropriate or not? And I would say that managers are really grappling with that. And that's the forefront of conservation right now, is really understanding what these changes are and then thinking through what the options are and deciding what's appropriate. And that's going to vary across time and space. So what may be appropriate in Acadia is maybe different than, you know, a woodlot owner's property who has different goals for their forest. And that, I think that also makes this fascinating, because it's going to be very different across the landscape as far as the management responses.
So again, what I see the science doing is providing options, and then it's up to the managers to decide what those options are appropriate for Acadia. Caroline, given your work on the insect that fascinates you, what options might Acadia or a landowner have to change the trajectory in some way?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I tried to answer this in a recent paper that just came out in Northeastern Naturalist, the product of my research in Acadia National Park. And I like to preface this by saying, like, the management decision-making is so difficult. I have so much respect and for the people who make those decisions, because it is really hard. And I really do hope that, like, you know, my research, Nick's research, all the research that happens in parks and elsewhere can really help inform those decisions. And really, the kind of the scientific background to some of my recommendations is that management and disturbance is really important for some species. Pitch pine responds extremely well to disturbance. So we literally need to keep that disturbance in the forest if we want to keep these different tree species around. And again, that's kind of a choice that we have, like, you know, we as a people have to make. And so just for some quick context, like, fire helps pitch pine by burning up what we might call the duff layer, kind of this layer of pine needles and branches on the ground. So all the nutrients that are in those fallen needles get incorporated into the very, what little soil there can be on some of these granite mountaintops. And the trees can then reabsorb some of those nutrients and that energy. It helps with pitch pine regeneration, helps the cones to open and the seedlings to grow. And it also helps pitch pine forest fire helps by reducing competition from other trees. Kind of how Nick said, you know, we might have, red maple coming up in the pitch pine stand. Is that something that we want to support, or we want to see what happens? And either way is okay. And remembering that these forests are dynamic. They have not always looked the way that we see them today, even though how we see them is so important to us and might shape our experiences in the park and inspire us to take action and care for the environment, which is extremely special. And so just quickly, if left unmanaged, we can expect pitch pine forests to probably undergo forest succession, which is totally a natural process. But fire is a natural process too. So, you know, management is really trying to consider all these different natural processes and trajectories and make a decision that's best for the land, for the people who come to visit, but keeps us safe too. You know, fire is not something that can be used everywhere. Having standing dead trees is also not necessarily the best thing right next to a trail where people are going to be, a lot of traffic is going to be going through there, and we don't want trees to hurt people.
Catherine, back to you. You make some reference to the fact that some people wanted to clean up the forest. Mm-hmm. That was a management strategy that perhaps was misplaced because we wanted to, or those people wanted to see a neat forest. Talk a little bit about that, and then we'll see if there's any closing remarks before we ask you to read a little bit more from this wonderful new book, The Trees of Acadia. Talk a little bit about that initiative to clean things up.
The perception of forests is shaped by our experience. And most of us living here in the Northeast have, most of the forests that we've experienced have been logged, burned over time, filled with invasive plants from elsewhere. Their soil is compacted. They may be polluted. Hydrology may have been altered. So Caroline, talk about disturbance. They're very disturbed. And so when we see a forest that's old, that's full of dead wood and fallen trees, and a forest that's operating the way it will on its own, there's a tenant, it's unfamiliar. And so seeing all that dead wood in the forest, as well as the fear of fire because of our history of fire, has a tendency to make people worried and concerned. And they think that all that wood on the ground needs to be cleaned up. And so I tried to just sort of address the ecological function of forests and the importance of that wood.
Great. Well, would you close us by reading from your wonderful book? And thanks to all of you. But go ahead with that passage.
This is from the chapter on hemlock, which is about winter. And so winter is ending. And it's also about the connections between forests, trees, and the ocean. The trees have given it all away, their leaves to the insects, their bark to the lichen, their seeds to the birds and squirrels, their shade to the deer and trout, their roots to the fungi, the rest to the sea and sky. In exchange, waves crash against the shore, sending salt and other minerals into the air. Wind stirs the surface of the sea, and fog drifts into the trees. Marine nutrients enter the forest via seabird droppings, seaweed wrack, and crab, urchin, and mussel shells left over from feasts of crows, otters, mink. Fish like alewives, eel, rainbow smelt, and even some brook trout migrate upstream from the sea, bringing carbon, nitrogen, and sulfur back into the forest, where a new generation of trees is growing in the sunlit clearings made by the last storm. And the hemlocks in their sparkling shade await the next. Spring has arrived, a miracle again. Every day, something new. The call of an oven bird, song of winter wren, siren of peepers, swelling buds of apple blossoms. Upstream in the valley, barred owls have nested in the hollow of a long dead hemlock tree. The first of two owlets fledges to a nearby limb. Dark-eyed, fluff-covered, the brancher owlet takes in the scene, ponders the next move. Even the leaves seem tentative, not quite sure of themselves.
Wonderful, wonderful. That's Catherine Schmidt reading from her new book, The Trees of Acadia, soon to be published by Down East Books. We've come to the end of a very short hour. Be sure and join us from 4 to 5 on the second Wednesday afternoon of each month for Talk of the Towns. Podcasts of our programs can be found in the archive section of the WERU website. If you have comments or suggestions for new topics, please email us news@weru.org. Our theme music is a medley from Coronach on a Balnane House Highland music recording. Thanks again to our guests here for Talk of the Towns, Catherine Schmidt, science writer and communicator from Skudik Institute. Nick Fisichelli is the president of the Skudik Institute, and Carolyn Kanaski is the forest ecologist and assistant professor of forestry at the University of Maine at Fort Kent. Thanks to our underwriters, thanks to Joel Mann for engineering our program, and to College of the Atlantic for production help. Stay tuned for Ralph Nader Radio from 5 to 6 and 2 hours of jazz on Groove Shop from 6 to 8. Liz Graves and I are producers and hosts for Talk of the Towns. This is Ron Beard wishing you a good afternoon.